You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
14 Mission 2, San Jose Avenue.
From our 901 Mission Street studios, you are listening to the San Francisco Chronicle.
Welcome to Total SF. No Heather Knight today. This is sort of a Total Vallejo episode. I'm speaking with Craig Brewer, a former Vallejo resident who directed Eddie Murphy's last two movies, Dolomite Is My Name, and Coming To, that's numeral 2, America, out on Amazon Prime Video today. I met Brewer back in 2005 when his film Hustle and Flow became a film festival hit and got a mainstream release. One of my all-time favorite interviews. I was driving a crappy Saturn at the time, and Brewer's car, he told me this, was a Subaru with one wheel like propped up on that spare tire. But we're there at Four Seasons in Beverly Hills eating $20 burgers. Larry Flint in a gold wheelchair is like two tables away. And he told me this incredible story. It was about his dad really letting him watch movies he shouldn't have watched. This is back in the VCR era. And then his dad died shortly before Hustle and Flow. But his dad's advice really fueled him as a filmmaker. Go back in the Chronicle, dig up that story from 2005. Brewer's a Memphis resident now, but I like to catch up with him every few years, and we always talk about the Bay Area. He was an ACT kid, American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco. And in this episode, we talk about his first video store in Vallejo, shout out George's TV, renting Eddie Murphy comedies when he was a teen. We talk about whether even 15 years into his Hollywood career, directing a lot of movies and big stars, if he ever stops nerding out having legends like James Earl Jones and John Amos on his set. They were both there for Coming to America. And we get into Bay Area movie theaters. Empress Theater in Vallejo, For the Win, hope they're doing well in the pandemic, hope to get back there someday. I'm Peter Hartlob, Craig Brewer coming up. This is Total SF.
Thank you very much.
Craig Brewer, congratulations on Coming to America and all the other cool stuff that you've done since we last spoke. Good to see you.
It's good to be here.
Yeah. You're one of my fondest journalism memories because I remember it was about 16 years ago, the Chronicle flew me down to the Four Seasons, which they never did.
I completely remember this. Yeah.
And Larry Flint was two tables away, RIP Larry Flint.
Right. And
I just remember like there were two people that, I mean, we did not belong in the Four Seasons, but it was like, they were bringing us food and stuff. And you told me your story and how you got into movies and about your dad. And it was just one of my favorite interviews ever. So it's good to be back with you.
I'm so glad. I remember that. Do you remember he was in a gold wheelchair?
Yes.
Yeah. It was, it's always good to talk to people from the Bay Area and get to remember all those times back home.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to start with just kind of your movie, how you got your movie education. And we're around the same age. I think you might be a year or two younger, but I remember video stores were coming up. There was a lot of good stuff coming out. I just wanted to ask you kind of how you got excited about movies.
Well, I think that what it was, I went to this school in Vallejo called Federal Terrace when I was in the fourth grade, and I became obsessed with Raiders of the Lost Ark. And I remember I would go into the library in the school and I would try to learn everything I could about the Ark of the Covenant. I was dead set on being an archaeologist, because you got to kiss girls like Marion, and you got to kill Nazis, and then I told all of my friends that we were going to have a Raiders of the Lost Ark birthday party. It was my birthday party at the time, and I now look back and I can see my mom now realize, like, oh my God, how are we going to do a Raiders of the Lost Ark birthday cake? You know, is she going to have to build it out of gold frost and like the Ark of the Covenant? You know, is it a Well of Souls birthday? You know, she wasn't a baker or anything, but all my friends came over, and it was just a very simple pan cake, you know, like those, you know, a sheet cake where you just kind of put it down, and she just covered it in blue frosting. And on top of it, wrapped in Saran wrap, was the Raiders of the Lost Ark script and storyboard book.
Oh my God.
And I'd never seen anything like that in my life. I didn't know that dialogue was written that way. I didn't know that they planned out the shots. And my dad and I just went over the script and just went over all of the storyboards, because when we would clean the house, he would play soundtracks all the time, but he would also play classical music, and he would also play soul music. And so it really kind of like always blended in my head, this music, script. And then I started getting involved in children's theater. But the biggest big bang came when George's TV Repair, which I believe was off of Tennessee Street in Vallejo, near my house, started to have one wall dedicated to video rentals.
Oh, yeah.
And it became kind of like a film festival in my house, where my dad, who loved movies, could then have free reign to watch old movies that he remembered, but also we got to see new things that he'd never seen. And that was, he would allow me to be with him during that time. And it really did lead to discussions about movies, you know, and I was just in, you know, grade school and then eventually junior high. And I do remember getting the making of Raiders of the Lost Ark one time from George's TV. And I got to see Steven, you know, worrying about making this movie. And then Thriller hit.
Oh.
And if you remember, Thriller had, you know, obviously the music video, which was like an event, right?
Sure.
But there was a VHS that came out called The Making of Thriller. And my dad and I watched that together. And I would watch it repeatedly. But I remember my dad and I watching it, and who's directing it, but John Landis. And there's this part where Michael is talking about how he was a fan of John Landis's and he had seen all of John Landis's movies. And so we just started writing it down. And I remember my dad and I having this night where we watched the Blues Brothers together. And I think the most I've ever seen my father like drop down laughing, like I thought he was going to die, was the nun sequence in the Blues Brothers, where the nun is beating Jake and Elwood, you know, with her stick. And then we watched American Werewolf in London, and then we watched Kentucky Fried Movie.
How old are you?
It must have been right before junior high. It must have been like probably fourth through sixth. I know that was kind of the spectrum of years that I was actively renting movies and watching movies.
I was telling my kids about like the lawlessness of the pre-Blockbuster era, because I could go and rent anything I wanted when I was like 11. I mean, there was no. And it's kind of like that for them now, I think, because they have my Netflix password and I don't know what they're watching. But
a lot of those mom and pop video stores had that back room where the adult movies were. I mean, you were just one, you know, push of a doorway away from just the most crazy stuff that, our young eyes could see. But yeah, I mean, I still remember like renting Saturn V. And Humanoids of the Deep. you know, I mean, crazy ass movies. I remember my granddad, who was a famous ball player, and he was also a famous personality, Marvelous Marvin Thornberry. He was in all the light beer commercials. He was kind of like the bald guy at the end of the Taste Great, mm-hmm. Let's Filling Gang. And he would go, I still don't know why they asked me to do this commercial. He came into town and he rented Gator Bait, and we watched Gator Bait together, which is a crazy movie, exploitation, sexploitation.
Movie. Yeah.
And I remember him turning to me going like, don't let your mom and dad know that we're watching this movie. this may not be for your eyes, but it's fun. So let's just keep watching it. So yeah, I know what you mean about that lawlessness. I mean, it's hard to think of it and compare it to the internet where you really could watch anything you wanted to.
Yeah.
You know? But back then it was much more taboo.
Do you remember your first Eddie Murphy movies? And we'll use this to segue into the movie you just directed. But was it Saturday Night Live first for you, or was it,
oh, it was Saturday
renting
Night.
Those movies?
No, it was Saturday Night Live. I mean, I try to explain to people like what it was like to suddenly see Eddie Murphy on Saturday Night Live and recording all of the episodes, and even trying to, you memorized every line of those, mm-hmm. of those skits that he did. And oddly enough, the experience that I remember, and I brought this up to Eddie and he just couldn't believe it. One of the first solo movie experiences I have, where I went to a movie by myself with my buddies, was to see Best Defense.
Oh my God. Now, with Dudley Moore. You remember
this movie with Dudley Moore?
Yeah.
Looking back on it, it makes absolutely no sense, because it's like, it's two movies that take, it's two different time periods and everything like that. But I think I went with a girl, and I think I got to like hold her hand. And I think we did one of those little like side kisses for the first time, where it's like you're not committing to kiss each other, but you're kissing each other. And I remember my cheeks getting red, because there's this one moment where like Eddie is having sex with a girl in the movie, but it's kind of funny, so everybody was laughing. So that's oddly enough my first cinematic moment with Eddie Murphy is on Best Defense, you know. But yeah, my dad and I, we saw Beverly Hills Cop together, and we were really big fans of Trading Places, and you know, that's when I, of course, like everybody else, fell in love with, you know, with Eddie. And you know, Dan Aykroyd was already in our sphere because of Blues Brothers and everything. And
Do you remember seeing Coming to America? You might have been in college by then.
I was in high school.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, it was another one of those things that my dad and I were going to see another John Landis, Eddie Murphy.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, it was exactly what everybody is saying it was. It was hilarious, but it was touching. It was something that like my grandmother could get behind, you know?
Yeah, and it was R-rated. And I'm sorry to cut you off, but it was, you know, there was really a musical element to it that, and an inspiring element, and his character is so sweet in it, and then, well, it's R-rated, so it almost was a little bit of a
well, that's what I take issue with people on Twitter and the internet that are saying like, what is this movie? You know, they've made this movie PG-13. Why didn't they make it rated R like the first movie? And Eddie and I have had conversations about this while we were making the movie. The only reason that the first movie was rated R was the bathers, and you know, excessive use of the F word, right?
Yeah.
That's really it. Otherwise, if you really look at all of the movies that Eddie was making during that era, from like 48 Hours, Coming to, 48 Hours, Trading Places, Beverly Hills Cop, and then everything he was doing on Saturday Night Live, Eddie brought attitude to everything. Uh-huh. He was always kind of he was the trickster. He was the guy that was the agent of chaos. Not so with Coming to America. Coming to America was a fairy tale. It felt different. He had this innocence to him, this really optimistic, open-minded naivete to everything American, where he even praised how we threw trash into the streets, mm-hmm. you know? And so one thing that Eddie and I had talked about was he even warned me. He's like, you know, don't get all caught up in this and think, you know, we had just made Dolomite is my name. You know, we are not fearful of nudity or MFing throughout the whole movie. You know, we had just done 2 hours of it and gleefully so. Yeah. But you know, he was the one that really said like, this is a special movie to me because it was different than everything that I was making, because it's hopeful and it's like a fairy tale, and he wanted it to remain that way. And so I take issue with people thinking that somehow the movie is ruined because we don't have those very small elements that turned a very wholesome movie into a rated R movie, especially because so many people over the years have watched Coming to America on TV.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
You know, you're surprised at how many people that's how they saw Coming to America.
Yeah.
We'll be right back after this short break.
I love all the music in this movie. I love, just every music beat is perfect, down to the little Bay Area reference. You got a little Humpty Dance in there. I don't know.
Thank you.
I'm going to try to avoid spoilers. I'll just let people discover it for themselves. It looked like it was fun on the set. I say like reunion vibe. It reminds me of like Godfather 3, and I'm not comparing your film to that, but I'm saying like there were points of Godfather 3 where like, that's the actress who played the same person who Sonny hooks up with, and she's now Andy Garcia's mother. And it's like, there were actors and actresses in this movie I haven't seen in 30 years, and they're all back for this movie. It felt like such a reunion. Was it fun on the set that way?
Yeah, it was. It was. I mean, I have no dirt that it was anything what people feel, because it was like people that hadn't seen each other in a long time now getting together. They're not only getting together, but they're getting in outfits and being these characters again, you know? Yeah. And I mean, I'll tell you like a moment that I'll never forget. One of my favorite scenes in the movie is actually a scene that I wrote between Cleo and Akeem. And it takes place in the back of McDowell's. And it's actually a rather touching scene. But it was the first time that Eddie and John Amos were working together. And so John Amos is sitting down, and Eddie comes in and gives him a hug and shakes his hand. And John looks at Eddie and goes, "Edward?" And he nods like this. And I was like, wow. Who in the hell calls Eddie Murphy Edward? And there must only be one man, and that's John Amos. You know what I mean? Like, and I was like, I wonder if he called him Edward back in the day. You know, I'm like, I'm still, you know, fangirling in my own way while I'm directing it. At the same time, I have to be kind of authoritative, but at the same time, I'm also just giddy. You know, so there were moments where, you know, I would tell my crew, we need to just wait like 10 minutes, let everybody get this out of their system, and then we'd get to work. You know.
Yeah, you anticipated my next question, which is, you know, you're an experienced director. It's been a lot of years since that first time we met and Larry Flint was there. But do you still like have a hard time keeping your cool when, like, you know, James Earl Jones and Wesley Snipes are on your set, you know, and are you still that kid who grew up watching those movies in Vallejo?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It never goes away. I think that you you get a little bit more confident to walk into the room, extend your hand, shake their hand and say, I love your work. I know your work. I've seen all of your movies. You're the kind of talent I want to work with. And then the best thing you could do is just be as honest with your vision and hear their ideas and listen to them. Empathy is something that doesn't really get talked about with directing. I think that's, at least the way I direct, that's very important. I want to hear what's on people's minds. I need to hear if there, sometimes I need to see if there's a problem that I haven't heard articulated to me, mm-hmm. you know, and ultimately my job is to make sure that they can be what they want to be. But yeah, when I sat down with James Earl Jones, I couldn't help it. I was like, look, I know I could sit here and talk to you about Darth Vader and Mufasa and all this, but I just want to tell you about the monologue you have in John Sayles' Mate One and what that meant. You know, and I remember the first time I saw Mate One and to see a smile on his face where it's like, people don't usually bring up Mate One, but it, and then a few stories come out of that, of me sharing that moment. And that to me is the great thing about cinema, is not only is it with actors, but I remember on Black Snake Moan, I think it was on one of these, but I said, hey, let's do one of those vertigo shots that they did in Jaws. You know, when Brody sees the shark eat the kid and then you push in on him and you zoom back at the same time and my crew starts laughing and I go, what? And they point to the dolly operator and they go, just talk to him. He did it. You know, it's like, that's what making movies when you're a movie nerd, you finally get to make them. It is. You realize that there's stories in every direction that you want to just soak it up. And so, yeah, like me meeting with Wesley, I want to know about the audition for Major League. I want to know about every story he can tell me. The same goes for, I just spent 2.5 hours on Friday talking to John Landis. And it was one of the best phone calls I've ever had in my life. Just hearing the stories, telling him what he meant to me, telling him what he meant to my father and me, and knowing that, you know, he's just a guy on the phone with me right now, but boy, was he important in me becoming who I am through his work. You know, it's a interesting artistic medium. It really is. I mean, it's like no other thing.
I'll tell you, you mentioned Wesley Snipes, and in this movie, he's your last movie too. I now think of Wesley Snipes as a comedic actor, and Leslie Jones made me laugh a lot in this movie. I think Wesley Snipes might have made me laugh the most
because he's hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, he has so much. He's a general. You can help me explain it. He's a general in the competing nation.
Yes, he is the well, what I love to tell people when people ask me what the movie's about, I go, you remember when in the first movie, Prince Akeem was supposed to marry this one girl, Imani, and she would do whatever he said. She would jump on one leg and she would bark like a dog. People go, yeah, okay. Well, her brother is pretty pissed that never happened because their nations didn't get joined together. Like what you see on The Crown and Game of Thrones, you know, where your job as a royal is to be married to somebody from a different nation. So basically trade routes can happen. And because Akeem went off to America to find true love, his nation did not prosper, and he's pissed. And now the chickens are coming home to roost, you know, and it's like he's saying, I'm going to attack. And when I met with, I called up Wesley because I basically always knew I was going to cast Wesley as that role. Like there were other ideas and other thoughts, but I just told Wesley, can you just hang tight? I'm just going to deliver this role for you because I think you and Eddie are comedy gold. And I can't believe that, you know, if you told me 10 years ago that you two would be like the new duo to watch, I just wouldn't have believed it. But they make so much sense together. They're two titans, you know, and they both are great in movies together. But I told him, I go, I want you to be a general, but just know that I'm sprinkling a little Landis on this. And I want your soldiers to sometimes accentuate what you say with rhythmical stances and stomps and hollers. And he loved that. And so I think that he put a little bit of rhythmical, you know, movement and mojo in the way he marched that kind of informed his whole character, and he would shout out things and people would respond. And I like to just get out of that man's way and let him do his thing.
Yeah, it was a very Public Enemy. It was like half Flav, half Chuck D, and then he had Security of the First World behind him. Nobody's gonna get that reference.
I got it.
give me a we're gonna wrap up soon, I know, but give me a Empress Theater memory for you.
Vallejo, I'll give you the best Empress.
It's still there. I hope they're doing well. I gotta do a health check on them in the pandemic, but still thriving.
I have two specific memories of the Empress. The first one was going to a matinee of Lord of the Rings with a bunch of kids. And it starts, and
this
I'm
the
not talking,
Bakshi?
I'm not talking the... Peter, I'm not talking Peter Jackson.
This is the Ralph Bakshi. Yeah.
This is the animated one that also incorporated that technique where they would basically kind of rotoscope over real actors. Mm-hmm. But it had the Hobbit characters that they had Frodo and Sam that looked much like the Hobbit character of that animated Hobbit that came out. So all of my friends, we were young. And we went to go see it, And the movie goes on and it gets kind of bloody. You know, it, I mean, I specifically even have a memory of like people coming forward with a sword and hitting people and seeing people like respond in slow motion animation with blood spraying out of their back. And I remember looking over at my friend's mother and she was kind of like, oh, I brought my kids to the wrong movie. But we just lapped it up. We loved it. Okay. But the real big one, and I remember seeing like, remember that movie, was it called White Knights with Baryshnikov?
Oh yeah, with Baryshnikov and Gregory Hines.
Gregory Hines.
Yeah. Say, I remember being in the balcony. Say it forever. Sorry.
Just oh yeah.
A little Lionel Richie in there.
the big Empress memory for me that really like changed, like truly did change my life, was my dad picked me up. And he said, we're going to see a movie. And I said, well, what's it called? And he goes, it's called Amadeus. And I said, well, what's it about? And he said, well, just know that I saw this play. My dad saw Amadeus with Ian McKellen as Salieri. Mm-hmm. And this was a Bay Area touring group that came into town. And Mark Hamill as Mozart. And he goes, yeah, Luke Skywalker played Mozart. And I go, oh, cool. Is Luke Skywalker going to be in this movie? He goes, no, he's not going to be in it. And I was like, Dad, I don't know about this. You know, why don't we go see something else? And he goes, no, I really want to see this. Let's go to it. And it's funny because I was the same age as my daughter is right now, and now I get that same from my daughter when I say like, come on, it'll be fun. We'll watch this movie called The Truman Show. And you think like, oh, The Truman Show. Why wouldn't you like The Truman? You'd be surprised if you got a 13-year-old daughter. It's like, it might as well be, you know, it might as well be Gone with the Wind. You know?
Yeah.
But I remember watching Amadeus and being completely blown away by it, by being completely immersed in this world of music. And I remember just having chills all over my body watching the moment when he's writing the Requiem Mass and Salieri is taking it down. I had never heard classical music broken down like that. And when years later I would be in rooms in Hollywood and I was trying to explain what I wanted to do with Hustle and Flow, and I was like, I know not everybody likes rap, but I didn't really like classical music, but there was something about watching Mozart and Salieri create this Requiem Mass where you just saw one line of the music being performed, then you saw another line of the music being performed, and then another one, then you heard it all together. You were invested in it because you watched it being created.
That's the whoop that trick scene.
It's the whoop that trick scene. And you'd be surprised how many people fought me on that. They're like, I even remember like one person saying, don't bring up the Amadeus thing in the room again. But it's just true. And I think that's why it won the Academy Award. I think it'd be different if they were just watching, you know, rappers rap. But because they watched them struggle to make it, just like Mozart was struggling to make that one piece, and I believe it's the second movement of the Requiem Mass, that completely changed the way I viewed classical music, and really, along with kind of like that John Landis music number, it was the first time that I really got the idea that like, I want to do movies that music is a part of, but you actually got to see the investment of the effort of art.
That's awesome.
Empress Theater.
Well, congratulations.
By the way, just as another person who knows that town.
Yeah.
Okay, so you know where the Empress Theater is?
Are we going to talk pizza versus burrito or no?
Oh, no, but I would like to know what that's about. But let me ask you this.
That might be new. Yeah, okay. Oh, I know Empress. I know where it is. Okay. I've been there, yeah.
There was a hardware store. It was like right around the corner of the Empress. And I have often wondered, when I saw Zodiac, and I had read, you know, Zodiac, yeah. and one of the main guys that they were following, that they believe, and even in Fincher's Zodiac, he was like, that's the guy. I've often wondered if that was I was watching Zodiac and I got chills because I was like, oh my God, I wonder if it's that one hardware store that I would always go into, because it wasn't a big hardware store. It was kind of like more of a mom and pop type of hardware store. Anyway, next time you watch Zodiac.
I'm a journalist, Craig. I will find the answer to that question. We have a Zodiac beat. We have a reporter on it. I'm going to find you the answer to that question. And next time we speak, I will have it for you.
That's great, because I would always go to Blue Rock Springs and hang out there. So it was always like, we always knew that the killings happened around. That's where my summer camps were.
Well, Vallejo, known for E40, the Zodiac killings, and Craig Brewer, congratulations on your career, and congratulations on this movie. I really deeply enjoyed it. I can't wait to watch it with my family. We watched the first one together. And
it was great talking to you again.
Yeah, and good luck to you, man.
You are listening to the San Francisco Chronicle. Thank you to Craig Brewer. Total SF is a production of the Chronicle. Our music is The Tide Will Rise by the Sunset Shipwrecks off their album Community, and Cable Car Bell Ringing by 8-time champion Byron Cobb. Support Total SF in the newsroom that creates it by treating yourself to a digital Chronicle edition at sfchronicle.com/pod.